Talk 1400 KFRU is proud to present the KFRU Heritage Series. It's a one-hour perspective on the events of the people whose lives have contributed to the heritage of Boone County. Listen each Sunday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. as we celebrate those who have become part of our history. The KFRU Heritage Series, presented by Columbia EDP, payroll that makes sense. From News Talk 1400, KFRU.
Many times I've had people give me suggestions for the Heritage Show, and along the way, people have suggested that I talk to a sports information director. And I liked the idea, and I never really followed up on the idea till I exchanged emails about something else with Bob Brindle, who was a sports information director at the University of Missouri some years back. And I asked him if he would join us on the program, and he has consented. And so Bob Brindle is our guest this week on the Heritage Show. And Bob, it's nice to see you again. How are you?
Good to see you, David. Good.
I want to say this about sports info directors, and I'll get your general reaction to this, and then we'll start to talk about some of the details that you can remember. I think you guys and women that are in the profession are some of the hardest working people I have ever seen in my life. I don't know if you felt that or not, but from my vantage point as a person that used to do a lot more sports, you people work hard.
Definitely a lot of hours. I don't know exactly how it is now, because I imagine technology has changed things a little, but yeah, I mean, it wasn't unusual to work, you know, 65 to 80 hours a week. That's for sure.
When a season was in, you had to be available all the time. And I'm trying to think to describe to people who probably heard sports information or media people for an athletic department or an athletic team, describe what your job basically was.
Well, you know, I guess you serve several different masters, and their interests are not always mutually exclusive. You know, I mean, on one hand, you're representing your coaches and student athletes and trying to help them with their relationships with the media. But on the other hand, you're there to service the media. So, you know, you have to provide them a place to work. You have to provide them access to the venue. You have to provide them with the information they need to do their job. Way back when, before there was so much instant communication, you were providing them with every statistic and tidbit of knowledge that could help them decide what they were going to cover. And, you know, they weren't always here, so, you know, you were dependent a lot on the U.S. mail, strange as that may seem, and, you know, and the telephone and face-to-face visits. And, and then at the games, you know, you were in charge of keeping all the statistics. You were the record keeper for the department. You maintained the archives. You produced the game programs. You produced the media guides. Definitely there were a lot of different things to do.
I'm glad you brought up media guides, because people don't realize that nowadays they don't do media guides like they used to. I think there was something that happened in the business a few years ago where some schools were presenting these huge media guides that cost so much, and it was a cost-saving thing, and it was one of those things that some of us, I mean, I kept them over the years, the media guides, because they were great record books, and they had information about the players, the history of the team, and all other kinds of information in it. I mean, it was really like an encyclopedia of that particular sport for that team that year. But now they don't do that anymore.
Yeah, and I can't see why there'd be a need to do them anymore, because other than a great keepsake, you're right. You can store everything online, and it can be immediately accessible with a simple search instead of flipping the page and trying to find the information. So, those things were a monumental amount of work, especially in football and basketball, you know, and literally took, you know, 2 months to produce. Invariably, something in it was going to be out of date by the time it rolled off the press. You know, that's probably not a problem anymore.
Bob Brindle is our guest, and we should just say that right now he works for MoDOT. You told me before we started the recording, special assignments or something. It sounds really, really cool. Much cooler sounding than probably it actually is. But you work for MoDOT.
Yes, I do.
And in particular, are you doing what again?
I'm in the customer relations division. But I work directly for our executive management team and the commission. on a lot of, you know, I write a lot of speeches. you know, I'm, you know, dealing with a lot of statewide messaging, both internally and externally. And anything else they tell me to do.
When, you know, I was thinking again back to sports information directors, it's kind of like being a press secretary for the president or somebody, because you're trying to show their side of something and be a spokesman for them, while at the same time understanding that the press needs to do its job also.
That's true. And I can remember, you know, funny story. I think the first year I was working there in 1980, I was with the basketball team. We were at a tournament in Atlanta, and we were at the tournament banquet the night before the games, and Norm Stewart, you know, was up there speaking, and he was introducing everybody that was along, and he introduced me as you know, SID, and he goes, "You know what that stands for, don't you?" And everybody was like, and I was like, "What the heck is he going to say?" And he said, "Son of a bitch in disguise." So I always thought about that. You know, I can see how that moniker could fit.
So did you, so 1980, you started in the job at MU, correct?
Right.
So prior to that, where were you?
Actually, I was doing the same thing at Lincoln University in Jefferson City.
Really? Did you come out of college and move right into that? What was the path to get to sports information?
Well, I was a journalism major here at Mizzou in magazine journalism, and probably like most students, I got my degree and didn't have any idea what I wanted to do with it. At that time, if you were going to be in the magazine field, you better move to New York, and I knew I didn't want to do that. And so I took a summer job in St. Louis, and I was just kind of looking around, and I saw this blind ad in the paper for sports writer photographer, but it didn't say where it was or what it was. And anyway, it turned out it was being the sports information director at Lincoln University. And at the time, my girlfriend was still here at Mizzou for another year. So I thought, well, you know, Jeff City's back close to Columbia. So I applied for that job and I got it. And so I worked there 5 years. And I was close enough to Columbia that I was still pretty in tune with what was going on at Mizzou, and got to be good friends with Bill Callahan, who was the SID at the time. And an opening came about in 1978 that I applied for and didn't get. And then it opened again in 1980, and that's when I came here.
You know, the interesting thing about doing it, and I'm just curious as to, again, your reaction. It's kind of like, some of us started at small radio stations where we did a whole lot of stuff, and then you become a little bit more targeted. There are a little bit bigger staffs. That's not so true right now as it used to be a few years ago. But, I mean, like at Lincoln, you probably did, I don't know, you probably didn't have a staff. You might have been the whole department.
I was. And, you know, sometimes that involved pulling out the bleachers before the basketball game. I've raked the infield a few times at baseball games, you know, and actually I helped a little bit as an assistant baseball coach because they didn't have any staff. So, yeah.
That's kind of cool, though. I mean, you look back at it probably at that point in time, you said, oh, my gosh, I mean, come on, we got to have some more bodies here.
Oh, I learned a lot that way. I learned how to do things. I learned a lot of shortcuts to do things. And I remember, I can't remember exactly what year it was, sometime in the late 70s, but Lincoln's president, James Frank, was the president of the NCAA. And at the time, ABC contract to do football required that they had to do a certain number of Division II games a year. And so since he was the president of the NCAA, they wound up doing a Southwest Missouri State Lincoln football game in Jeff City. And so that was my first brush with live TV. Well, they bring in this big crew, and, you know, Lincoln Stadium has it's a nice stadium, but it only has bleachers on one side. Uh-huh. And they face to the west. And so the producer got there, and he said, this isn't going to work. And I said, why not? And he said, well, we can't have the camera shooting into the sun during the game. And I said, well, I don't know what the alternative is. And he said, well, I know what we're going to do. We're going to build a press box on the other side of the field. So they hired a construction crew, and they came in, and it was unbelievable. They threw up this structure about 20 feet tall in like 2 days. To put their announcers and cameras over on that side, and then they trenched all the cable around to the trucks on the other side. And I was talking to the technical director, and I said, this seems like an awful lot of effort for a Division II football game. And he said, Bob, this is nothing. You ought to see what we've done to some of the world's greatest golf courses.
Really?
So,
oh man, and that was back in the 70s.
It was like 78.
We're
something.
Going on 40 years from that, and just think then. I mean, nowadays TV gets whatever they want,
yeah.
And I mean they can recreate whatever. But I'm surprised back then. But you know, the other part of that was, I mean, if they had stayed looking that way and the sun wasn't a factor, it would look like they were playing in front of nobody.
Exactly, which they practically were anyway. But
so televised Lincoln and South. What did you say,
Southwest Missouri
at that time?
Missouri State now, yeah.
Bob Brindle is our guest. Let's talk about Bill Callahan, because that's a name that a lot of people still remember. So, what do you? How long was he like SID at Missouri?
Oh, 35 plus years.
I mean, that's amazing.
And he was, I mean, he's my mentor, wonderful man, one of the best writing SIDs I've ever been around, and I think he taught me how important that was. I mean, if your credibility's on the line when you're dealing with reporters who are great writers, the stuff you provide them better be well written too. I'm not so sure that's the case anymore, but that was important to me. The other thing was is that I mean, he worked for almost all of his career with no assistance.
Really?
I mean, completely reliant on student help. And, I mean, I was only the third assistant he ever had. And, you know, he worked unbelievable hours. And the other thing was, besides being a great writer, he was a tremendous teacher to so many students, and that was something that I think I took from him, too, is that, you know, the journalism school teaches you how to write, but they don't really teach you how to do the job. And, you know, I think that was one of our roles, was to help so many student journalists here learn how to develop a source, how to know when it was right to call that coach in the middle of the night and when it wasn't. You know, what access you had at a practice and what you don't. I remember one time when Vahe Gregorian was a student reporter for the Missourian, and now he's the columnist for the Kansas City Star.
He used to be at the Post-Dispatch for a long time.
And
it's hard for some of us to realize now he's at Kansas City, but he moved across the state.
And he's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. But one of his very first practices, it was in the stadium, and I was standing with all the reporters on the sideline, and I looked up, and Vahe is standing in the middle of the huddle out on the field. And I think it was either Larry Smith or Bob Stull, but anyway, he said, "Hey, Bob, could you get this kid out of the huddle?" And I had to go out there. He said, "Vahe, you can't stand out here." And I mean, really, he didn't know that you couldn't go anywhere you wanted. Now, you know, so I mean, that's a small example, but I do think that that was one of our roles, especially in this community, was to help teach so many young journalists, because you know they're on every corner.
Callahan, what kind of demeanor did he have? What was he like under pressure situations when you had things that you're having? Because I saw you many times having to handle a dozen things to two dozen things at one time.
Bill was a pretty low-key guy, except that he was a fast-talking Rhode Islander. You know, and all the years he lived in central Missouri, he never lost that Rhode Island accent. You know, and he had such close friendships with so many reporters from all over the country. You know, back then, people stayed at places a long time, which they don't anymore. But there were so many giants of the profession that were around all the time, and he knew every one of them so well. And he had the ability to pick up the phone and call anybody and get, you know, make contact with him anytime he needed to. He was a neat guy.
How did the writing, I mean, because some people think, well, you like you said, the reporters are going to do the writing, and they're not going to just take, if they're decent, they're not going to just take what you wrote or you write and use that. But explain a little bit more the importance of being a good writer as a sports info director, because of the way that will, again, lead some credibility with the writers who are going to be looking at what you put out.
Well, you know, when Bill started, and actually continues today, but, you know, a lot of Missouri is serviced by small weekly newspapers or and so who weren't going to be able to come to Columbia and cover the Tigers. So, you know, Bill, in addition to writing a press release every week on Sunday, he'd write a feature on a player every week as well, a short little feature, and we'd mail those out on Sunday nights. Well, the small papers around the state, they'd run that stuff word for word because you were filling inches in their paper that they couldn't fill any other way. So he was a great storyteller, and, you know, he had a – every week he would have a couple of athletes come sit in his office for an hour or two, and he would just, you know, probe into their life and find something interesting and then crank out a – one or two page feature, and we'd use those in the programs, or we'd include them with the press. And sometimes there was some little nugget in there that a reporter would see, and then they'd want to expand on it themselves.
Yeah, interesting. Bob Brindle is our guest. We're talking about sports and sports information as it was developed at the University of Missouri. He was hired by Bill Callahan, who many of you will know that name, a crucial name for the sports info at Missouri. And then Bob Brindle took over at that, and we're going to continue with him after this. This is the Heritage Show on KFRU.
This is the KFRU Heritage Series, presented by Columbia EDP. More coming up on News Talk 1400, KFRU. This is the KFRU Heritage Series, presented by Columbia EDP. Payroll that makes sense. From News Talk 1400, KFRU.
The Heritage Show. This week we're talking Mizzou sports. Bob Brindle, who is a sports information director there, he says in our first segment, started out as a sports info guy at Lincoln, came to the University of Missouri in 1980. And how many years did you serve that role at MU?
20
years up to 2000. You mentioned technology a while ago, and I want to I'm going to interject a personal thing here. I went to Northeast Missouri State for a couple of years before transferring to MU, and I worked with Bill Cable.
Bill Cable.
Do you remember him?
I'm very well.
So I worked a year as I was one of the students up there, and I basically was his sports info student, and it was amazing. I mean, I can remember covering Northeast Missouri State Bulldog football, and he sat at a typewriter. I think it was electric, but I'm not quite so sure. And he would type out the game play by play on sheets that were mimeographed, rip them off. I'd have to go to the mimeograph machine and copy those things and distribute them to the press. I mean, you want to talk about technology. This would have been mid-70s.
Oh, all right. You know, we were still using those mimeograph and ditto machines until, you know, deep into the 90s, probably. And, you know, you talk about a manual typewriter. Well, Bill Callahan used an old Royal typewriter until the day he retired in 1985. And he was so technologically challenged that he didn't know how to change the ribbon on that thing. You know, he probably used it for 35, 40 years, that he used to run the ribbon back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until it wore through, and then he'd call me or his secretary to come change the ribbon because he didn't know how to do it.
That just was amazing to think, though. I mean, if you would tell kids now, guess what? You're going to be sitting up there. You're going to be typing this on a typewriter. You're going to be having to mimeograph this off and then distribute it that way. I mean, that's ancient. That's old, old, old style, several generations back.
Yeah, how many times did you pull that master off and get that ink all over your clothes?
Did that, and or it smeared on that. But, yeah, I can remember some of those times and have to do that. But that's what it was. I mean, that's what a sports info guy, in addition to having to contact wherever the athlete was at the college or university, you wanted to get the information back to their hometown media outlets, radio, television, newspaper, so that they could know that somebody who went to high school there or grew up there had had a good game. I mean, that's part of it, too.
Yeah, very much so.
So let's talk about some of the – you told me before we started the program that you went to the same high school. You knew Gary Link from high school days.
Yes, I did.
So he was a year apart from you. But how interesting is that to end up then here and to know of Gary Link at the university? You have any memories or stories about good old Gary when he was a high school kid?
He, you know, he lived right next door to the high school. He was a tremendous basketball player. but he was also a great tennis player. And he's 6'5" or 6'6". You can imagine what his serve was like. He was a really good player. But actually, his senior year, when Lindbergh should have won the state championship, but they went 30-1. It's pretty good. That team was so exciting that I think following that team really created my love for basketball. And then when I came here, he was playing here. And, he became a completely different player in college than he was in high school. In high school, he was the inside guy. He got a lot of garbage baskets. But he actually wound up playing a lot as a guard here at Missouri and became a pretty good outside shooter.
How close of a relationship did you get with some of the players that you had to, and you mentioned have to make them understand how they can handle the press? I think that's an important thing also that sports information departments do with students, because a lot of times they've never had any contact, at least not regular contact with the media. But who do you remember that was really a quick learner or did that very well during your time that you'd say, oh, these people had a pretty good sense of what it was like to be a college athlete with some fame and handled that role well?
Corby Jones would be one. Melvin Booker.
Did you meet with them regularly? I mean, with teams at the first of the year, did anybody say,
yes,
all right, here's what's going to happen?
Yeah, we always met with the team before the year and tried to explain to them the things that they, little things that they should do to help deal with the media. Don't ever go off the record. Two, don't ever say no comment. Just say, I'd rather not answer that question. Just keep your answers short, 20-second sound bites. It takes a lot of reinforcement because most of them have never been in that situation before. And I think by and large, most of the kids here grew over the course of their career and did really well with it. But, communication is something you're going to have to do the rest of your life. So, and most of them weren't going to continue playing sports afterwards. So just being able to communicate well, I think is an important lesson.
Did you ever have problems with media people who, you mentioned Vahe Gregorian a while ago showing up in the middle of a huddle during a practice, but I'm also wondering about how many of them tried to do an end run around the department and said, nowadays, I mean, now with Twitter and Facebook and those kinds of means, I think it's happening all the time. But what was it like in your time?
Oh, there was always people trying to do that.
Yeah.
And that was frustrating because I think we had pretty open channels of access for the media that it was disappointing when those weren't good enough. But on the other hand, you can't hate the reporter who, is aggressive and driven to do a good job as well. You definitely didn't want to build up and, get so mad at somebody that you built up an adversarial relationship because you know where that's going to end. You don't want to fight people that, buy ink by the barrel, they always get the last word. So, there definitely were there were times that it was hard, but I
did you have come to meeting come to Jesus meetings with any reporters that you felt like you had a good enough relationship with that you could ask them, hey, what's the purpose of this or why were you doing this?
I'm sure I had a few, but At the end of the day, I think it worked out okay. I mean, I think a young reporter has to understand both sides, and I think eventually they learned it.
Did you get phone calls at all time, day and night?
Yes, that's something I don't miss for sure.
What would they call about?
I
hear something is happening. Can you tell me this?
I've seen a name in a police blotter. I saw some so-and-so get hurt at practice today. I lost my press pass, and I, I mean, it could have been any number of things.
So when, I mean, they come to you for that kind of stuff, and you'd have to either run interference. Did you generally get a word? How often were you surprised by if somebody called up and said, hey, you know what, I've looked at the police record, or there's a rumor going out? I mean, you don't want to have that be news to you when you get that phone call from a reporter.
Most of the time it was news to me. You know, a lot of times that was the first time I'd heard of something. And so then you got to run the traps and find out what the story is. And that was something I mean, I hated that. Yeah. Unfortunately, it happens way too often.
Norm Stewart would have been the basketball coach when you came here. You already told us one story about Norm Stewart. What else was it like working with Norm Stewart and reading what his sense and feeling and emotion was in line of dealing with the press and with your department?
Norm was great. I loved working with Norm. Now, sometimes he drove me crazy, he was just, he's a guy that could, he could charm a crowd as easily at Booch's at lunch as he could at the Country Club of Missouri at dinner. You know, I mean, he could adapt to any situation, and he always knew the things that would resonate with people. And, I used to see the national media come in here, and he'd sit with them for hours after practice and just, he would tell these unbelievable stories. I mean, he was probably better with the national media than he was with the local guys he saw every day. Mm.
Did he have favorite ones or unfavorite ones that you knew, if this guy is going to be doing the game, Norm's going to love it, or if this guy is going to be doing the game, it's going to be a little bit cold?
Yeah, probably. But, back there, when we had the Big 8 Network and Jay Randolph and Fred White, and Gary Thompson, those guys came. Norm had a great relationship with them, and they'd tell stories. We'd go out to dinner, and till late in the night, they'd tell stories. And I learned a lot of history through that. And, Norm was... he's got such the recall that he has on things is amazing.
I think sports info guys are the same way. I mean, they can really remember things pretty well. But I mean, you're talking about perhaps specific incidents and specific games, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Norm, I mean, he'd pull out, I remember, this game, blah, 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 3 minutes to go, and so-and-so's at the line, and there's, we're in the 1-on-1, and blah, blah. I mean, just... I remember a lot of things, but I can't remember the details like that.
Yeah. We're recording this around the NCAA tournament. They're in the midst of the Sweet 16 going to the Elite Eight on the weekend that we record this. I think it's going to play a week or so after that. But I'm just curious as to what were the seasons, especially of men's basketball, where, I mean, it just takes on, in my limited understanding and contact with this, when you get to the NCAA tournament and if you play in a few rounds, it takes on a whole different, it's just a different animal then. Can you describe to people,
it really is.
What does that become? I mean, what's that like?
Well, those 3 weeks of March Madness is really intense. And there's a lot of stuff that you just don't know until the last minute. You don't know where you're going to be traveling. And you got to build in travel time. You got to put together all these postseason guides that, you have almost no time to do it. And then you've got to transport it there. You're dealing with a whole bunch of media that maybe you don't know. You're operating under a whole bunch of rules, tournament rules that are different from the regular season. You're dealing with CBS that has their own expectations. It gets... it definitely is a pressure packed time. And you don't want, as an SID, you want to take away as many of those distractions as you can from the coaching staff and the players so that they don't have to deal with all that minutia. And sometimes that was hard, but after you've done it a few times, you can anticipate some of what's going to take place.
Do you remember some places that you went, some of the really neat places that you had an opportunity to go to through the NCAA tournament? I mean, we haven't talked football yet. We may do that in the next segment, but I think basketball's on a lot of people's mind right now.
Well, you were
doing it when Tyus Edney did his thing.
I was there. Yeah, you had to bring up Tyus Edney. And actually, the game before that, actually, we played Indiana when Bobby Knight was still there. And that was one of Bobby Knight's famous outbursts after the game. Huh. That, the NCAA has a rule that after a game, you get a 10-minute cooling off mm-hmm. period. Then the losing coach speaks, and then the winning coach speaks, and then the locker rooms are open, which we never had an open locker room during the regular season. So that was always a big change. Well, we won the game, and we were in Boise, Idaho, and our locker room was a long way from the interview room. I mean, it was a long walk down a maze of hallways. And so we got to the locker room, and I said, Norm, I said, we've got 10 minutes, and then Bobby's 10 minutes, and then you're on. And he goes, heck with it. Let's go right now. So I said, okay. So we walk down there. Well, we get there first. Knight's not even there yet. And we wait. And the moderator of the press conference was getting increasingly nervous. And the media was getting restless. And he comes down and he goes, let's put Coach Stewart on first. I said, no way. And he said, we're not going first. Because if Coach Knight walks in here and Norm's up there, I said, I don't even want to see what that's going to be like. And we wait some more. Well, now it's gone on and on and on. Finally, the tournament director came and he said, Coach Stewart, go ahead. And no sooner had Norm taken that step up that here comes Knight through the door. And I don't know if you've ever met Bobby Knight, but he's an intimidating guy. He's huge. He's like 6'5", and he's got the biggest neck I've ever seen. I mean, he came in. He was furious. And we finished and I was standing there the whole time, and he kept looking at me like I had caused this. I was like, Coach, believe me, Coach Stewart did not want to go. And Norm finished, came down the steps, and he went up there, and he ripped that poor moderator a new one with every word in the book. And it was on, at that time, ESPN was streaming live those press conferences. I don't know how many bleeps that they had to have, but and I think Knight got fined by the NCAA committee for that.
Oh, man. I mean, there are rules, and they are very strict rules.
Yeah, and it's
but
hard.
But coaches are on their own. Coaches want to do it their own way.
Well, the NCAA tournament's difficult because at the end of every game, there's a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
It's either, because it's either over or you're so euphoric that you just want to move on, and dealing with those emotions in those press conference situations is hard. It really is hard. And, and going into the locker room with kids crying and stuff, I mean, when you haven't had your locker room open all year and all of a sudden it's open to the world, that's really difficult.
Mm. We're going to pause, come back with one final segment. You're listening to Bob Brindle. He's our guest. This is the KFRU Heritage Show.
This is the KFRU Heritage Series, presented by Columbia EDP. More coming up on News Talk 1400, KFRU. This is the KFRU Heritage Series, presented by Columbia EDP. Payroll that makes sense. From News Talk 1400, KFRU.
Our time is flying with Bob Brindle, Sports Information Director for the University of Missouri from 1980 when he started with Bill Callahan up to 2000. We talked to basketball the last segment quite a bit. I want to ask a couple of things here and just get some impressions of athletic directors. You have to help me remember athletic directors during those couple of decades. Who would have been the men heading up the athletic department at the University of Missouri?
Dave Hart, Jack Lengel, Dick Tamburo, Dan Devine, Joe Castiglione. Mike Alden.
Yeah. Did you have, you're representing coaches a lot. How important a relationship was it with this, with the athletic directors, and what were they like working with them?
Oh, it's definitely important because they chart the path for the whole department, and, you know, they've got a, an idea how all the different pieces they wanted to want them to fit together. Dan Devine was without a doubt the most interesting guy to work with, and
why is that? I mean, I know his son pretty well, and I always have had great admiration for Dan Devine because growing up in North Missouri, I mean, that was a name you just knew.
Well, Dan Devine was kind of a hero of mine. I mean, he was the coach at Missouri when I was a kid. Uh-huh. You know, I can remember, you know, when I was 13, 14 years old, cutting the grass on a Saturday afternoon with a transistor radio in my back pocket and an earplug in and listening to every game.
Yep.
And so when he came back here, actually my freshman year at Mizzou was the first year he had left Mizzou. So when he came back here as AD, you know, that was a difficult point in time. You know, at the time, Missouri was without a chancellor, and I believe Jerry Bruder was the interim chancellor, and we were also without an athletic director. And Jerry didn't want to make a hiring decision for the long term when the next chancellor really needed to make that decision. And so he worked out this, you know, interim arrangement with Dan coming back. And Dan, you know, Dan didn't really want to do it, I don't think. You know, he was living in Arizona. He was very happy there. He was working with foundation that worked with drug abuse, and that was very important to him. Plus, his wife was not in good health. But he had an incredible loyalty to the University of Missouri. And he came back here, and he did that. And you know, he really, I think, changed the future of Missouri athletics in a very short period of time. Because at the time, there was a lot of sniping between St. Louis interests and Kansas City interests. Football was losing. And there was a little bit of a lack of commitment from the administration towards athletics. And he pulled all of those people together in a quick period of time, and working with the board of curators, I mean, he made some changes that that really everything that's followed hinged on those decisions. You know, a lot of the improvement, you know, Missouri hadn't made any facility improvements in years, and Dan told me once that, you know, he never thought that facilities were all that important when he was a coach here. And he said, you know, we had a lot of great seasons, and I never asked for anything after any of those seasons. And he said, you know what, that was probably a mistake, that I probably should have asked for some things. And he said when he was at Notre Dame, it kind of hit home when they were recruiting some kid, an offensive lineman, and I can't remember his name, but it was a very high-profile person and somebody who went on to greatness in the NFL, I believe, and was a person who was a three-time academic All-American, so a very smart kid. And it came down to Notre Dame or Michigan, and the kid picked Michigan. And Devine couldn't hardly believe it. He said, why are you going to go to Michigan? And he said, because they had carpeting in their locker room.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, he, working with the curators, he put in place a plan to start improving Missouri's facilities. And the Devine Pavilion was, you know, one of those things. You know, we didn't have an indoor facility. So Dan did a lot of things, but I think more than anything, he mended the fences between a lot of different factions in the state, which was really, really important at the time.
You know, let's keep it on football. I would guess that a sports information director is privy to a whole lot of information ahead of time that you'd have to keep quiet sometimes. I mean, you knew a lot of things that you couldn't talk about, correct?
Yes. and sometimes that was agonizing because, you know, maybe a lineup change that that might be critically important to the way the game's going to be played. But if you tell the wrong person and it shows up in the Saturday morning paper or in advance, maybe it gives the other team mm-hmm. some kind of competitive advantage. Those types of things always made me uncomfortable. Now, there's a little... It's a little different now because now the coaches almost always meet with the TV guys the day before the game. And those TV guys are savvy enough to know that they won't keep their job if they they let some of that stuff go. So coaches, I think, tend to tell the TV announcers a lot more. But, I mean, I do remember a football game when Bob Stull was here playing out at Colorado where we had two really good wide receivers in Lindsey Collins and Byron Chamberlain. Who were probably about the only weapons we had on offense. And they were both listed as starters on our depth chart, and they both got hurt in practice on Thursday, and neither one of them made the trip. And knowing that they weren't going to play, it was hard as heck on Friday not to say to people that you're not going to see either one of them, because Colorado would definitely have defended us differently. And then, you know, we walk out on the field on Saturday and neither one of them are there. And Irv was like, why didn't you let us know that? And I was like, well.
Can't.
And I couldn't. And I, yeah, that was probably, probably should have. But, boy, you know, I would have had, I couldn't watch, look the coaches in the face if I had.
Well, you would have had to answer to them because they would have said, hey, what are you doing? Yeah. Because your role is to give information, but you also have a loyalty to who you're representing. Quick, just a couple of minutes left. When football or coach changes occurred, it didn't have to be football, when coaching changes were occurring, though, were you would know when that momentum of rumor started, and you knew how rumors were wrong sometimes, and sometimes rumors might have some truth to them. How hard was it to deal with that and to earn the trust of the new person hired?
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, coaching changes are always hard because you build a relationship up with those coaches, and more than their coaches, their families, their assistant coaches and their families. And, you know, when there's a big change, you know, that's difficult. But you got to move on as fast as you can, and you got to start building relationships with the new people. And, you know, unfortunately, it happened too many times while I was here. And, you know, Missouri had not fired a football coach in decades before Al Onofrio was let go. And Al Onofrio was a great, great man. He did a lot for Missouri. And ultimately people recognize that because he's in Missouri's Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. and yet he was a coach that was fired here. But once you fired somebody, it's easier to fire the next guy and the next guy. And, you know, and I think you saw that happen over the course of the 80s and 90s at Missouri. And, you know, every time you fire a coach, you set the program back a certain amount of time because somebody comes in new. They've got different ideas. They got to get their players in. And that was a real tough thing for those two decades when Missouri was kind of wandering around in the wilderness of football. Because it's like, okay, how long a rope do you give somebody? And yet at the same time, there's other pressures. That was a really hard time. And all those coaches, they had their own strengths. But, you know, circumstances may have made it impossible for them to compete.
Yeah. We're out of time. It's been one of my most enjoyable Heritage shows because I've admired what you did at the University of Missouri and how you did your job, and I appreciate you agreeing to come on and talk about some of the memories. They're terrific to hear, and we could do this all over again and do it all with new stories, and maybe someday we'll do that. Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Bob Brindle, our guest. That's the Heritage Show this week on News Talk 1400 KFRU.
You've been listening to the KFRU Heritage Series, celebrating the history and heritage of Columbia and Boone County. Presented by Columbia EDP, payroll that makes sense. And News Talk 1400, KFRU.
Columbia.